The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. We've got a special edition, I guess you could call it. We're going to deal with some tax topics. Jim is not on the show today. I've got a special guest, Bob Palachek. Welcome, Bob.
Hello, Chris.
Before I forget, I do want to let everybody know that Jim did make it through his surgical experience yesterday and is doing well. His voice is not up to doing the show today, but I suspect he'll be back on the show very shortly. So those of you who are waiting to hear, Jim's doing just fine, and we'll hear the gory details about it when he gets back. So today, that's why Bob is joining me. This is a perfect time for us to take advantage of his expertise in the world of taxes. We've got a series of questions. This isn't the Q&A show, I know. This is an EDU show, but we're going to do kind of a tax-focused Q&A and call it an EDU show. So a couple things. Bob?
I'm here.
Are you delaying filing of returns because of the newly announced May 15th, which is actually the 17th because it's a weekend tax deadline date?
I'm still pushing to have everything done by the April 15th date. A couple reasons. It's no sense, dragging out the busy season, and, you know, we want to get everyone's taxes done and everyone wants to get their taxes done. And I have a vacation planned on April 23rd. So there's another little small reason.
You mean the IRS didn't consult with you before they pushed back?
I did call or thing went to spam and I didn't answer it. And so I missed out on giving my feedback on any of that. But so they went ahead and did what they wanted to do.
Yeah. Well, it is what it is. So
it does take a little pressure off. And, mm-hmm. If we have any listeners who for some reason still are kind of stuck, or maybe their preparers not getting to the return or something, because we have a little extra time and we have a little extra time in May. And if you're not concerned about waiting till May 15th, reach out to us because we could probably take on a few more still.
Okay, that's good to know. So today we've got a variety of tax questions that we've kind of been letting build up in the background, if you will. Jim's been hoarding them, I guess is another way to say it. So let's just tackle these one at a time, and I think it's a good mix of stuff that hopefully people will find of interest. So this first question comes in. It's been a little time. Some of these technically are dated, but the reason why we're still talking about them now is that they're valuable for upcoming tax strategies and things. So this one's technically sent to us in 2020, so they're going to be talking about 2020, but the same type of thinking needs to be considered for 2021 and beyond. So here's the question, or the email itself. My wife and I, both 56, have each contributed $7,000 to our Roth IRAs for 2020, which you can still do. By the way, they extended the they officially clarified, although those of us who read the law occasionally know that the deadline for making a previous year's contribution to your retirement account for your IRAs and Roth IRAs is actually not a specific date in the rules. It's actually tax day. So when they change tax day, that gets extended is my understanding. But they did. I did notice an IRS release here in the last couple of days that they extended it officially so that you can make a 2020 Roth or traditional IRA contribution if you qualify for the tax year 2020 still. So while you're listening to this, you still have time to do that. Back to the email. We would also like to convert an old IRA to a Roth. Present value is $93,000. My concern is that combined income married filing joint is $160,000. I understand the income limit for contributing to a Roth is $196,000 married filing joint. Would the conversion cause any problems for the Roth IRA contribution we already made earlier this year? So they have a further question, but we'll stop there. Will the conversion kind of retroactively bite them and prevent them from making a Roth contribution for 2020, Bob?
The conversion in itself will not hurt them or prevent them from doing the Roth contribution earlier in the year. One does not cancel the other one out. But the second part to this and the part that they're going to run into trouble with is the income issue. And they don't specifically say the 160 is AGI or taxable income, but I'm going to assume it's AGI because they're referencing it later in that sentence. Right. So if we go with 160 AGI, the writer's correct. The 196 is the bottom of the phase out of when you're allowed to do a Roth contribution. Mm-hmm. 206. So it's a small window. 206, it's over. Right. $10,000 window.
Right. Which by being 160, that's what keeps them in the qualification category for making a Roth contribution. They're able to do that because they are under the 196. If they do a conversion that pushes their AGI over the 196 or the 206, where it'd be completely phased out, that doesn't disallow the contribution. Conversions don't contribute to the qualification of you actually making a contribution for a given year.
That's right. Okay.
But then they go on, I understand it'll put us in the next tax bracket. We'd like to retire at 60. Currently have, and I'm not sure, they have another $1.3 million in some other retirement accounts. So taxation issues, they're about to hit a new, they're close to the top of a bracket, I guess, is the issue to be concerned about, right?
They're close. You know, the 176 is around the top of the 22% bracket. So the next 124, I mean, that's not too big of a difference to pay another 2% if you're really eager to make that Roth conversion. You know, it costs another, I guess that'd be about $1,800 or something to do that. I kind of look at it like there's really a bunch of options in their situation. It kind of depends on a lot of things, what they're looking at in the future. But a few things to consider up front is, could they convert, up to $36,000 this year? You know, spread the 93 over 3 years. That would allow them to convert in chunks, basically stay in that 22% bracket and still do their Roth conversions. So that's one idea. Mm-hmm. A second idea is convert the whole thing. And if that's, and I get the impression that's their only traditional IRA account. So if we convert it, my understanding is it would be gone. And the rest of the money is in employer accounts, 401ks and 403bs, which aren't counted as on the pro rata. I guess what I'm getting at is if we get rid of all that basis at once, our income is going to be too high. But then we can recharacterize the two $7,000 contributions as non-deductible contributions and convert those basically in the back to a Roth plan and convert those into a Roth that way.
Got it.
Pay a little bit more, a little bit more tax, the extra 2%, but that would kind of work. Sometimes, you can always play around when you're still working and you have these employer accounts and most of them accept rollover money. You know, the plan has to be set up for that, but most are. you can slide some or all of that IRA out of the way, tuck it away, and then kind of have your ability to play around with these Roth conversions and contributions and not affect the pro rata rules of making those conversions.
Well, if they've got, since they're still working, they didn't really share with me or us the how much of this is coming from earnings and as far as the 160K that we started with. As long as they're going to stay at the 160K, they don't have to worry about doing backdoor contributions. They can just do those contributions. So it's not, but they're close to that 196. So if they start recognizing other income, not conversions, because conversions don't affect this, right? It's going to be other income that comes in. So I'm not sure we don't have all the information about their situation to really kind of nail this, but there's things to consider here. They're young enough where they're not having to worry about potential kind of side effect issues with IRMA or ACA credits at this point, because they're still both working, probably contributing or participating in an employer plan. So some of those other things, if you're a little bit older, you're looking at retirement and you're doing these things, because conversions do contribute to your AGI for ACA credit determinations if you're going to be between retirement and Medicare age. So they don't have some of those moving parts. Yeah, you're right. If they clearly indicate they've got a 401k, so if they wanted to set themselves up for future backdoor Roth contributions, because they're worried about they're going to continue to have increases in income over the next few years, they're only 56, they could possibly roll that $93,000 into the 401k, thus freeing up or zeroing out their traditional IRA, so they don't have to worry about the pro rata rule for the backdoor Roth techniques. So, but isn't it true, as long as they're going to stay at that 160, conversions aren't going to disallow their direct contributions that they're making right now, right?
You know, I think that is correct. I was thinking my first concern was that we were going to bump their AGI above the 196, but the conversion in itself doesn't prevent them from doing the Roth conversions, and I guess that is excluded from the AGI test.
Yeah, we've dug into this before. It was a while ago, but found that the conversions don't contribute to the qualifier for the Roth contribution itself. So people were running into that issue where they were converting heavily enough that it pushed them above, say, the 206 figure, but then they also had made a contribution and they were worried that that was going to disallow. And best information that we have is that is not the case. The conversion itself is not going to be the trigger for disallowing a Roth contribution, as long as your other income, taxable income, is below that 196 figure for the Roth phase out that starts at 196. But they are teasing right at that $172,000 tier, but you're right, the 22 versus 24 bracket is not a huge difference. So if they're really trying to fill up the Roth, that's not going to necessarily be a limiting factor, but they're really close. If they're at 160, they don't have far to go before they're going to be pushing into that next bracket from their current 22 bracket where they are now.
Yeah, it might be a good thing to spread out, you know, over a couple years. I don't, you know, we're not seeing a lot of threat for tax increases before 2025, at least in this range of income. Mm-hmm. So, you know, spacing out over 3 years, and that kind of works too, and it does save a little bit of tax.
Okay, the next question is also regarding conversions and backdoor Roth contributions. So this is a little different setup as far as their situation. Doesn't indicate where they're from, unfortunately. But the email goes, I'm 64 years old, my wife's 60. We've got $700,000 in a traditional IRA and $75,000 in Roth IRAs. I'm currently contributing the max of $26,000 into a Roth 401k, so they're full participants in the Roth 401k at work. My wife does not have any retirement plan at her job. We currently earn over $220,000 and can't do a Roth IRA contribution directly, right? For the reasons we just discussed, right? They're over the 206. Neither of them can do a Roth direct contribution. My wife plans on retiring in a year. I plan on retiring at 66 and 6 months, so about another 6.5 years from now. My question is, should we use any extra funds to do Roth conversions or do backdoor Roth, which is the question. So nice short email, but there are some key elements I think that are missing. Bob, at $220,000 with only $700,000 in the traditional IRA, is Roth particularly attractive, or do we have enough information really to make that determination?
You know, we kind of really don't have enough information to know what we would need to really fill in the blanks and really understand and start to plan for this couple is what kind of income are they going to have in retirement after they retire? Do we have pension income, or are the tax brackets out in the future going to be that much higher that we should, look at converting while they're working? Cause they're in the 24% bracket. There's a lot of room in the 24% bracket, but that's a fairly expensive bracket to convert. If you're going to be needing that IRA money throughout retirement, as far as your part of your withdrawal strategy for spending, or is it kind of excessive? And that's going to kind of determine, where should we start converting? Possibly after she retires. I think she retires about a year or so before him, a couple years before him. So we're going to see some kind of income drop there. So maybe it starts working into some conversions during those periods of time, and then convert more after both are retired and before they're age 72. It may make sense to do some conversions. Again, we don't know. Also, they don't point out to us how much they have in maybe taxable accounts to pay tax on conversions to be able to live on before age 72. It might become more of a withdrawal strategy kind of thing. That $700,000 is going to grow, but those first years of RMDs aren't going to be probably too excessive.
No, and that's what I was kind of keying on. We don't know what their other income sources are in retirement. They don't make any mention of a pension or other sources. They just talk about the traditional IRA and the Roth IRA. If what they need to look at, and others in a similar circumstance, is look at your other taxable income sources that are going to be happening, particularly after RMDs kick in. The RMD on $700,000 IRA isn't particularly large. It's about $28,000 in the first year. So that combined with some Social Security income is not going to put them in a particularly high tax bracket, which makes current Roth even contributions not particularly attractive in my book if they're making $220,000 this year. But what we don't know are the missing pieces here. They might certainly have, maybe they have a bunch of other assets. Maybe they got a bunch of non-qual money that's also generating interest and dividend income. And there's just moving parts here that we don't necessarily know about. But that's kind of how you have to weigh this. Look at the income situation for tax purposes after you retire versus now. And that's going to give you an idea of the attractiveness of doing what they're doing, Roth contributions, which really also plays into the Roth conversion attractiveness as well. Now, while you're retired, working, once you're retired, but before RMD age, you've got a lot of flexibility in there because you can defer distributions from those traditional IRAs if it makes sense from a tax perspective. But the typical argument for doing these Roth contributions and additionally possible conversions while still working is if you're really spooked by the size of RMDs in your future, kind of this income that you cannot control, if you will, and they're just not that massive in the story that they're telling. So I'm not sure. The only thing I would say in argument for Roth right now while they're working is they don't, unless they have other assets they're not revealing to us, don't have a lot of what we call tax diversification. The vast majority, almost 90%, is in always taxable. So it doesn't give you a lot of wiggle room. But because the overall dollar amount isn't enormous, only 700,000, it's, and I hate to, I'm not saying only 700 derogatorily. That's just, it's only 700, which causes manageable, from a tax perspective, RMDs. And they're likely, if these are all, their only resources, going to be taking money out of those accounts even before RMD. So their, you know, distributions might just kind of handle their tax situation. They might have a relatively flat tax profile. They don't, I'm not seeing the type of situation where they have this big spike in taxes later on in life as RMDs kick in. But we don't know if there's more to the story that they're not sharing with us here. So any other elements to this one that you can think of that they should consider?
No, that was a good summary. It takes as you can see as we walk through these questions, it takes a lot of different parts and a lot of different pieces of information to really fill out the whole picture and really know what to do. And then, you know, when we even think we know what to do, the software really, you know, kind of confirms it for us or pushes in a little different direction or another. And another thing, and I'll point out in any of these situations is how aggressively invested are these folks and how aggressively invested do they want to be? Is that $700,000 very conservative 3% kind of growth rate, or is it very aggressively, you know, where there's maybe 6% or more possible growth rate in the future? That also affects the planning. Mm-hmm. Do we want that growth, a larger growth? We want it to grow tax-free. Smaller growth, it becomes less advantageous to pay that tax up front.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Give them some things to consider, at least in their weighing of the attractiveness to each one of these directions. So this next question is pretty recent. It technically came in 2020, but is right at the end of 2020. So it's based on, a current information, if you will. Let me dive into the question. There's a little preamble here, but let me dive into the question itself. It says, my goal is to retire when I'm 63. Wife is 60. We have a healthy reserve of $2.5 million. I have a small $8,000 a year pension starting at 65 and Social Security that will more than cover our minimum dignity floor. I will defer Social Security till 70 and my wife will take hers at full retirement age of 67. Like many boomers, we're not so good on tax diversification. So for easy math, let's say $2 million is of my $2.5 million is always taxable. $350,000 is maybe taxable, and $150,000 in Roth never taxable. I plan to start doing partial Roth conversions and continue perhaps all the way until age 72. By living off our sometimes taxable, we can do both the conversions and still try to take advantage of ACA. So in this case, they're trying to take advantage of the Affordable Care Act, ACA, premium credits, which are available essentially up to the point where you are recognizing AGI up to about four times the national poverty level. So there's a limit, and for married couples, for a household of two, isn't that, it's in the 75,000 range, 75,000, 80,000, right?
That's about right. It's about 18,000 poverty level for a household of two in the lower 48. It's a little different in Hawaii and Alaska, but so for roughly four times 18, you're in the the 70s kind of range.
Right. So if you have AGI above that limit, you can pretty much say goodbye to ACA premium tax credits. But if you're below that, which is what they're talking about here, so I'm just taking this segue to explain what they're talking about. They're trying to take advantage of ACA credits while still doing Roth conversions. So they continue, certainly until I can go on Medicare at 65. But if we run out of those assets before my wife can get on Medicare, does it make any sense to tap the Roths to continue with ACA credits for her health insurance and still do Roth conversions? So let me back up. They're planning to tap their maybe taxable for the most part, so it doesn't generate a lot of AGI, and use that to live on in the pre-Medicare years, thus qualifying for ACA premium tax credits is their goal. But they don't have a ton. They've only got their maybe taxable is $350,000, and don't tell us what their living standard is, but they're delaying Social Security. So they're going to have a what we call a delay period, which is those periods, that period of years from retirement until all your secure income is turned on. In this case, he's waiting till 70. So there's a, you know, a several year delay period there. They're going to take distributions, at least the plan, from their maybe taxable accounts, hopefully while qualifying for AC premium tax credits. But if they run out of that, if they start taking money from the always taxable very quickly, $75,000 or so, they're going to hit the limit where the ACA premium tax credits would go away completely. And the question is, should they tap the Roths? And even beyond that, and so my answer to that would be possibly. Let's look at the value of those credits and look at what your long-term goals are for taxes and see if it makes sense to tap the Roths before a lot of people would normally do so. We have a lot of people that intentionally leave Roths as one of the last assets tapped so that kids inheriting them can inherit tax-free money instead of always taxable and being forced to distribute it within 10 years, right, with the loss of the stretch. So I guess, Bob, would you agree it's a maybe as far as should they then start tapping the Roth if they run out of brokerage account assets, what we call maybe taxable, in order to retain the ACA premium tax credits for his wife in particular?
You know, it is a maybe. And just a couple of things to kind of think about or just to throw out there is, one is this: in this situation, the spending needs will run most of this show. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if they're, you know, low spending people, stay at home kind of folks, and their annual spending limits are kind of on the lower end, then, you know, they probably can get through with, you know, kind of with the assets they have, they can probably get through to age 72. But if their spending's higher and they want it and they're really go-go and they're traveling and spending a lot of money early on, that's when I think they're going to kind of run into more trouble. And the solution is going to be to look at that window. They have a short window of really good years to convert. Where conversions, you know, I would look at a couple years of more meatier conversions, maybe 22, maybe into the 24, maybe to the top of the 24% bracket for like those 2 years where they might have to give up the ACA credit and we would factor in that cost. But ultimately, is a tax savings going to exceed, mm-hmm. you know, what the loss of that credit's going to be?
Right.
And again, that's the numbers that we can crunch and we can come back and say, okay, it's going to cost us, you know, $25,000 to lose the credits, but we think we're going to save $100,000 over the course of retirement. Does that, you know, and how comfortable are you with paying that tax and taking that chance? And the numbers usually come back and in this case could very well tell us to do that.
Right. And that's kind of how to weigh it when you're dealing with these, I call them side effects. They're not directly an income tax, but they are effectively a tax. I call losing a credit a form of a tax due to income. So the side effect taxes can include like the ACA premium tax credits we're talking about here, or the IRMA, right? The income related monthly adjusted amount, the Medicare premium surcharges. Those are a side effect. NIT is a side effect. There's lots of these, quote, side effects, loss of deductions or loss of access to certain credits are side effects in this that you've got to consider, not just the tax bracket that you're in. So what Bob said is absolutely right. We see it all the time. It can make sense to create the side effect or be okay with the side effect in that you're losing the ACA credit or maybe you pay an IRMA premium for a year in order to do something that in the long haul will save you substantially more in just pure income taxes. It can make sense, but in other cases, it doesn't make sense. The loss of the credit is painful enough where it really doesn't seem to justify doing conversions or other things that you might be looking at doing as, you know, in trying to manage your overall tax situation. So I stopped at the point of where he's talking about using the Roths to kind of keep their AGI down to do that. But he continued kind of with that Roth idea that take Roths out because they ran out of brokerage account money, but still do conversions. And he points out, it seems like robbing Peter to pay Paul. And that would be true in a year where you're going to take a Roth distribution while simultaneously doing a conversion. You may as well just take the money directly out of the taxable IRA. There's no reason to do the paperwork to do a, you know, you're basically doing two transactions to end up in exactly the same place as one transaction. So just from an efficiency standpoint, you may as well do that because you're going to recognize the income dollar for dollar the same, whether you're converting it or distributing it. And if you're just moving it one account and moving it back out of the account effectively, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So I think the bigger question is what, you know, Bob alluded to, is weighing ACA premium tax credit loss with the potential for income tax savings down the road, particularly if you believe income tax rates in the brackets you expect to be in, either you as a couple or one of you as a survivor. Don't forget to look at those. A lot of times people focus so much on their current status, married, filing, joint. So they look at all the brackets. They make all these predictions. They talk about, you know, the fourth, fifth, sixth brackets going up in their assumptions to make an argument for doing or not doing things today. But even if tax rates don't go up, your tax situation is likely to degrade, possibly tremendously, at the passing of the first spouse. We call it the widow-widower tax penalty or the survivorship tax penalty, where the survivor has to file single a year after the first spouse's passing. And the spouse, if they retain all the taxable, always taxable accounts that the couple had, they're going to be faced with similar RMDs, particularly if they're about the same age, similar RMDs, but forced through much narrower tax brackets, which can cause that penalty. And that, in and of itself, I would say if it looks like kind of an even a wash, convert now versus not doing it, and you're saying, it's not going to save me much. I'm going to convert now or have a distribution later. I'm going to be close to the same bracket. Look at the survivorship brackets too. Because if it's a wash now, but it really helps you with a survivorship scenario, it makes perfect sense to do the Roth conversions now. Because it's not, quote, harming you as a couple, but it's really benefiting you as a survivor. And so if this sounds difficult to do on your own, you're exactly right. Even for professionals, this has always been difficult. Luckily, there's some newer software out there we've been using for a few years now. And there's several programs out there. I don't know that there's a ton of them that are readily available for the do-it-yourselfer market. But there's some of those, but I'm not mentioning it because you have to have the software to do it. It's just much, much easier. And it's really easy to miss some of the side effects if you aren't building everything into your analysis. I know there's a lot of listeners who are do-it-yourselfers are going to run out and write a spreadsheet to try to do all this. That's not too bad when you're writing a spreadsheet just for your family, right? You only have to cover one case. Not that I'm wanting everybody to do that. Not everyone is talented enough to do that, but it is possible. But those are the things you'd have to build into that spreadsheet. These credits, IRMA, NIT, all this stuff. And then you're making assumptions about the future too, which obviously is an unknown, but is going to affect your conclusions here. So I think that's it. Other than the last comment, I guess I'll share this with Jim when he gets back. They say, P.S., we spent a whole year deciding on where to settle down in retirement. If you want, he'll give us a free coffee and opinion, second opinion, to hear about the process and help Jim decide if he wants to move to Kentucky. As a full disclosure here, in their signature, turns out they chose not Kentucky. They chose Virginia. So they're writing to us from Virginia instead. So it looks like they might have considered Kentucky, though, and they want to have some ideas to share with Jim. So I'll make sure Jim gets hooked up with them. I'm still, those of you that have been listening for a while, to this day, Jim has still never set foot in the great state of Kentucky.
He has this incredibly romantic kind of notion of how it is.
It's almost like, exactly. It's like he has this vision like Kentucky is Bali High, right? And there's this vision in his mind, which lovers of Kentucky probably find it to be a vision of glorious retirement. I'm just saying Jim should probably visit there once, maybe once in every season. I don't know how many seasons they have there.
I think they have four.
Do they get all four there?
I think they do. Northern Kentucky has a winter. Yeah,
I know there's a winter and there's a sweaty summer. I wasn't sure they'd have the other two.
But, probably squeezed in there somewhere.
Yeah, so anyway, this person is offering to give him some advice. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, Chris, I was just going to add one more thing to this last email. And when you were kind of talking about, you know, spreadsheets and the do-it-yourself was trying to figure this out. And I've had some clients send in some really sophisticated models, very impressive models. Mm-hmm. And they cover, you know, they cover a lot of the things that, you know, it'd be easy to miss or forget about, but they've thought through these and they've played around with them and stuff. And even a really good one I saw recently missed one fairly important thing, and that is brackets go up every year, and we don't know exactly, you know, where they're going to be. But when I say they go up, is there's an inflationary creep to the bracket numbers themselves, mm-hmm. and it's about historically, it's been about 2.5% a year. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, when you're out 20 years, 2.5% a year is a big change,
right?
And so, you know, somebody was concerned, and they knew they were going to be in what will be probably a 25% bracket if we go back to the 2017 structure. And so they were looking at that and thinking they were going to be well past that 25% bracket, and they were very nervous about their retirement age tax rates. And that's a good, you know, it's a good thing to be thinking about it. And that's why we do a lot of conversion analysis for people. But in fact, when I pointed out the fact that those brackets, the 25% bracket, where that was likely going to be 17 years from now, he was actually underneath that number. Mm-hmm. And so his planned rate wasn't as really bad as he was thinking. That's not a reason to not, you know, really look at all this stuff closer, but I'm just pointing it out. There's so many things to think about. It's very hard to get everything down in an Excel template.
Good point, because we don't talk about that tax bracket creep very often, but that is definitely something that you'd need to build into your modeling, because it absolutely is going to happen. At least, I mean, I guess they could stop that, but that'd be quite a divergence from what they've ever done. I've never seen them do that. The brackets have always been increased over time. So,
you know, we see a little bump every year, whether, you know, and so in it, it's incremental. It doesn't look like much. It's a 2.5%, but. But when that's compounded over 20 years, 30 years, there are radically different numbers. Even while you're projecting, well, my Social Security goes up every year, my RMDs go up every year, you can figure out what that's going to be likely. But so don't the other brackets.
Mm-hmm. Yep, perfect. Okay, next one. This is a very different question here. So we've got, where are they from? Also from Virginia. A lot of action from Virginia today. That's cool. Here's an interesting idea. The CARES Act stimulus checks were an advance payment of a 2020 tax credit, but it was paid based on the most recent tax return on file. If you are married filing joint and your most recent tax income tax return showed you earning over $150,000, your stimulus check was reduced. They had that really tight phase out that ended up in the final bill, right? It phased out from $150,000 to $160,000. So when you hit $160,000, no stimulus check for you. So over that very tight $10,000, and there's, not to deviate too much from this email, but there's a whole bunch of people that are really bumming that they were in that phase out, because that extra $10,000 worth of earned income they maybe had ends up taxing them effectively over 100% in a lot of scenarios, meaning between the extra income taxes that they owed and the loss of possibly significant amounts of stimulus payments, because they lose it at 160, that $10,000 worth of income that they earned, that they thought they were doing right by their family in earning that, actually cost them more than $10,000. Anyway.
And that was something they squeezed down for number three.
Yeah, so that's...
The first two, we did have a $50,000 window.
Right.
And so that's what where he's kind of going with this, is there was a larger window earlier on, and then as to save money for round three, they squeezed it.
Yeah, so this is before the latest version. So I was jumping ahead just because it was kind of fresh and people have heard that. So yes, when he wrote this, he's talking about when there was this phase out between 150 and 200. So back to his email. So if your most recent tax income return showed you earning over 150, your stimulus check was reduced. If you reported over 198, you got no stimulus payment at all. If a couple is able to reduce their 2020 taxable income below 150, they can still get the entire tax credit when they file their 2020 tax return. Ways to reduce income include making contributions to traditional 401ks and IRAs. So he's talking about kind of in preparation for filing, doing something about your 2020 tax return. This is a little dated. The reason why we're talking about this now is some of this stuff's going to go on here in 2021, possibly as well. So in this particular case, you can still make IRA contributions for the 2020 tax year, but Bob, correct, you cannot make a retroactive 401k contribution at this point, correct?
Correct.
Okay, too many corrects there, but
yeah, right.
You get what I'm saying? I got carried away.
You could do an HSA.
So you can do a few things for the prior tax year. We're in 2021 as we're recording this. But he is correct. When you were back in 2020, before the end of the year, if you were trying to whittle down your reported taxable earnings so that you can get more of this stimulus check, making pre-tax contributions to those accounts could have helped you do that. He goes on, if a person is on the cusp of getting a stimulus payment, this is effectively an additional 5% tax on earnings because the stimulus payment is reduced by $5 for every additional $100 earned. This was the old CARES Act stimulus checks, which people filing their 2020 tax returns still could end up qualifying for some of those. Because like the latest round of stimulus checks, they're kind of advancing people based on the latest tax information, but then allowing you to reconcile it when you actually do file your taxes later on. So he's essentially saying, let's strategically consider doing some things, which is to include making traditional contributions rather than your typical Roth in order to maybe shove down and qualify for more of the stimulus check, either the CARES Act stimulus check, the second round, or the latest third round of stimulus checks, which have a little different rules than what we're talked about here. So this I'm sure you picked out because there's a lot of people going through this right now with the current situation, right?
There's a lot of truing up going on because the way they wrote these acts was the 2020, your 2020 taxable income was going to let you know if you qualified or not, or if you were in the middle phase out range. But they don't, they didn't have 2020 information, even though everything is based off of 2020. So they used what they had, which was 2019 and or 2018 to qualify people. They sent the checks out and then the whole true up reconciliation is 2020. Fortunately, if you got it and you weren't supposed to because your income went up in 2020, you don't have to pay it back. I think everybody kind of knows that. But if your income went down, either you planned for it or it just worked out that way. And I've certainly seen quite a few people add to their refund this year. It's added to your tax return as an additional refund or subtraction from the balance due is this stimulus money that became available to you because your income went from non-qualifying in 2019 to qualifying in 2020.
Mm-hmm. So people didn't get the automatic payments already because they were going based on their 2019 tax return, which is the latest that they had on hand. But in 2020, if you did have this reduction, either you know your work was cut or you retired early or who knows, you know, what it could be, or it was intentional because you saw these types of calculations being made and you intentionally put more into your traditional deferred accounts, your deferred tax deferred accounts like your 401k at work, or redirected what was going into Roth, moved it over to the traditional category, or even now. So right now, we're recording this March 30th of 2021. We're still in that phase where you can make 2020 contributions to traditional IRAs and HSAs. Are there any other kind of retroactive 2020 income reduction methods that you've run across, Bob, that might get people to qualify for stimulus money that they otherwise wouldn't?
You know, it's similar to the traditional IRA. If you're self-employed, you can make a SEP contribution. That can be a good
way to
bring your income down. Mm-hmm.
So those are any others? I can't really, off the top of my head, I can't think of any.
Those are the easy ones, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And this helped out a lot of college students that graduated last year. I've seen a few of these too.
So here's one. Yeah. So it's not an income difference. It's a, was I a dependent or not difference?
That's a second part of this. So if your child or was in college and he was on your return or she was on your return for 2019, they were not eligible for the stimulus checks. Now, if your eligibility was in the right range, you might have gotten, you know, a stimulus payment for them. This year, they're on their own. They started working. They worked half the year. They're claiming themselves. They're supporting themselves. They now become eligible for the two stimulus checks from the prior year, and that gets added onto their return.
Mm, that's a good point. So if you've got children that are kind of starting to become emancipated and on their own, make sure that they're aware of that. They're not going to reach out to you to make sure that this happens correctly. Are there any extra forms or any extra sheets that you need to be added to your return in order to claim this?
It's called an RRC, so it's a recovery rebate credit. So there's an RRC worksheet, and whether you're, certainly your tax preparer is going to be hopefully following up on this with you, or if you're doing it yourself, I know TurboTax and a couple of the other home software tax preparers will ask you about the check amounts. Make sure you put in what you received, and if you got a reduced amount, put in the reduced amount, and it's going to calculate for you if you get more or not. And it can't go down, so that's good. It can only go up.
Nice. One last point I'll make, since we mentioned it, the HSA contributions. Not everyone can contribute to an HSA. Remember, you have to qualify. You have to be participants in a qualifying high deductible health plan. So whether employer or through the marketplace, they're available both ways, but you have to be enrolled in one of those plans to make an HSA contribution. So you can't, if you weren't enrolled in one of those in 2020, you're not going to be able to make a 2020 HSA contribution here retroactively, trying to reduce your taxable income for purposes that we just discussed here. But if you were participating and you didn't max out your HSA contribution, you can do that still retroactively, as long as you qualified. So just keep that in mind. The others are more obvious, but people sometimes forget the HSA limitation. They think, oh, that's one I hadn't thought of, and they rush out and try to do that. But they've got to be on a proper high deductible health plan. Okay, well, I think that kind of wraps up what we needed to do today for our kind of tax-focused show. If others have tax-related questions, certainly send them in to us, and Bob's going to probably start to free up over the coming weeks as tax season starts to wind down, and maybe we'll get him on the show a little more. I know you're going to take a little break after you file your last tax return. Do you ever file returns when you're on vacation?
I've filed extensions.
Have you had to do that?
I have filed extensions on vacation before. I've had people reach out to me and I've done that, and so I usually have it with me.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you don't have to do that this year. But yeah. So send your tax questions in. We'll accumulate them and do a show, just kind of like we accumulate some of the estate planning questions and then have an estate planning attorney on the show. Send those by going to the website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or you can email them directly to jim@jimhelps.com. Either way works. And thanks for being on the show here.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Glad to join in. Took a little break from doing tax returns and come in and talk about taxes.
Excellent. I'm impressed with the length of your beard now. It's filling out nicely.
Oh yeah, tax season. That and the hair, it's starting to look like a wild child, I guess. But
yeah, do you have a Harley?
I do not.
Do not. You're starting to get that look about you.
I have a little bike I ride around, but I'll clean up here. Okay. Clean up pretty good.
Cool. Well, thanks everybody for listening to another EDU show. We'll be back with you next week with another show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.